Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop update on advanced ovarian cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, general cancer organizations, caregiver organizations, and also ovarian cancer organizations. And I do want to call out to the ovarian cancer organizations that have collaborated with us on today's program, and that is the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition, the Ovarian Cancer Research Fund Alliance, and Share for Women Facing Breast or Ovarian Cancers. Now, because of that collaboration and your interest in this topic, we have over 592 participants on the call today. And you come from all over the United States. And we also have quite a few of international participants from the following countries, from Argentina, Canada, Costa Rica, Japan, Switzerland, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So this is truly a global call, actually, and we really are delighted that you've all chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, today's program was made possible by Clovis Oncology, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this really very much needed program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. Dr. Runowitz is Executive Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Florida International University, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine. And Dr. Runowitz is a GYN oncologist, and she will be addressing an overview of ovarian cancer, including, of course, advanced ovarian cancer, therapy options for recurrent and advanced ovarian cancer, and germline or heritable BRCA 1 and 2, and somatic or acquired genetic mutations. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you. I'm delighted to participate once again. I find these conferences to be very helpful, and it's in a very short period of time, up-to-date information. So to give you an overview of ovarian cancer, the initial management is generally cytoreductive surgery, or debulking surgery, as we call it. And this should be performed by an experienced team, which should be led by a gynecologic oncologist. It's been shown in numerous studies and in other fields that the high-volume surgeons do better or have better outcomes with their patients. And so you really want to find a center that treats ovarian cancer and has a significant number of surgical procedures and patients undergoing treatment. If preoperative evaluation or comorbid conditions eliminate surgery as an initial option, one can treat with what's called neoadjuvant chemotherapy, or that's when chemotherapy is given first and surgery is delayed until 3 or even 6 cycles of treatment are given. The surgery at that time is usually less radical because the chemotherapy has debulked the patient. First-line therapy is pretty standard in this country and around the world, and is a platinum-based chemotherapy. The chemotherapy can either be given intraperitoneal, that is in the abdominal cavity as a belly bath for patients with optimal or with very little tumor residual. And there's another regimen called dose dense, which is weekly paclitaxel in combination with carboplatin, which is given every 3 weeks. This was initially pioneered by the Japanese and has been repeated by several other large groups. Survival data is pending, but it looks like a very active regimen. Bevacizumab, an anti-VEGF monoclonal antibody, has been added as first-line therapy and for maintenance therapy and is another very active drug. Most patients will initially respond to those therapies. Unfortunately, most patients will relapse. The time to relapse is very important in deciding on second-line therapy. Before I discuss these options, I'd like to briefly review the pathology, although we have a pathologist on the call who will go into more detail. But we used to think of ovarian cancer as one cancer type, and we now know that that's totally not true. My overview is going to focus on the high-grade tumors and not talk about the low-grade tumors. And in the high-grade tumors, there are several subtypes, including mesenchymal, immunoreactive, angiogenic. And these subtypes may eventually play an important role in selecting the best therapy for first line and beyond. Dr. Jatoi will speak about precision medicine and its relevance in ovarian cancer, and will be probably based on some pathologic markers. At surgery, the GYN oncologist will have the pathologist determine the type and often request certain molecular markers. So as a patient, it's important to know what type of ovarian cancer you have and how much tumor was left. Was this an optimal or a suboptimal cytoreduction or debulking surgery? And that will help in determining the best treatment options. Now, and we'll hear from our pathology colleague about driver mutations and other markers that may be useful in predicting selection of therapy and response to therapy. So therapy for recurrent and advanced ovarian cancer. Advanced ovarian cancer is stage 3 and 4, and that is where most patients present. About 70% of patients present with advanced stage ovarian cancer. When it comes back, it also can be spread throughout the peritoneal cavity and other sites, and it can also come back as a small volume or as a large volume disease. For first recurrences, and even in the second and third line settings, the time from the last treatment from platinum predicts response to treatment with platinum and other therapies. So in first recurrences that occur more than 6 months to a year from treatment, most of us would recommend a platinum containing regimen. In other words, retreat with platinum, usually in combination with another agent such as Taxol or Doxil or Topotecan. Recurrence at 6 months or less suggests platinum resistant, and other treatments should be considered. At this point, a clinical trial should be really highly considered, because there are many, many active drugs in clinical trials, and the window of opportunity may close if one is too heavily pretreated. So there may be some good drugs out there that are in clinical trials, but you are only allowed one or two prior therapies. So if you go on what I call street drugs or standard therapy, you may lose the opportunity to get some of these newer drugs, which may be more active or as active, but are clearly under study. One can access a clinical trial by going to the NCI, the National Cancer Institute website for clinical trials, and then just picking ovarian cancer as the cancer, and then there's a category called recurrent. And there will be pages and pages and pages of trials. It's sometimes hard to understand, and a patient navigator is often very helpful in looking at these pages to determine whether there's a trial that you're eligible for and that may be reasonable because it's within a certain distance. If the trial is at the National Cancer Institute, they actually will pay for you to stay at the National Cancer Institute, and there will be no charge. So this is clearly, in my opinion, something worth investigating. So I won't go through a lot of therapies because Dr. Jatoi is going to talk about some treatment approaches. But there are many new drugs that are out there. So bevacizumab I mentioned, but it's been used in the platinum-sensitive and in the platinum-resistant setting, and is very active. So that is something that your doctor, medical oncologist, GYN oncologist may recommend. Then there's a group of drugs, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, sudarinib and pazopanib, have been shown to have activity. Then there are some new anti-angiogenic agents, which differ from bevacizumab, the angiopoietins. Trabapanib is one, for example. The PARP inhibitors are also very exciting, as they interfere with repair of DNA single-stranded breaks and have emerged as very active treatments in ovarian cancer for patients with BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. However, the mutations can be germline, that is, they're inherited, or they can be acquired in the tumors. And I'm sure from our pathologists we're going to hear a little bit more about that and about the BRCAness phenotype, which would again predict response to the PARP inhibitors. And in combination, the PARP inhibitors have actually been shown to be active, and there was a combination that was reported out from the Boston group, which was olaparib with sudarinib, and it was actually a chemotherapy-free strategy and was very active. In other subtypes, clear cell, for example, there are active agents, but unfortunately I don't have the time to go into that, but there are some active agents that we see in clear cell that we might not see in serous carcinoma. So in summary, it is critical to choose a gynecologic oncologist with a high volume of surgery and follow with state-of-the-art treatment based on the tumor type, the residual disease, the patient's performance status, and then for the first recurrence, most of us would give a platinum-containing regimen, but the option of clinical trials should be front and center at any point once ovarian cancer becomes recurrent. So I know I only had 8 minutes, and I gave you my lifetime of 40 years in 8 minutes, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ronowitz. That was really superb, and Dr. Ronowitz has spent her really career in this area, and thank you so much for kind of really synthesizing it in such a cogent way and so eloquently for everybody on the call, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Amina Jatoy. Dr. Jatoy is a medical oncologist, and Dr. Jatoy is professor of oncology, associate director of research education, Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. And Dr. Jatoy is going to address how precision medicine may inform your treatment decisions, new treatment approaches, and clinical trial updates. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Jatoy.
Well, thank you so much for that very kind introduction, and it means a great deal to me to be part of this program and to be able to talk a bit about new therapies and specifically about precision medicine and how it may help patients as they think through decisions in conjunction with their healthcare providers with respect to cancer treatment and specifically ovarian cancer treatment. I'd just like to start out by saying that precision medicine is an extremely interesting area of investigation right now in cancer therapy. I'd also like to make the point, however, that I think that as medical oncologists, as healthcare providers, we try to be careful about not boxing patients into a particular approach up front. We like to be able to remind patients that precision medicine might well be of help to them, but similarly, conventional chemotherapy may also be a great help to them, and also other types of approaches that are perhaps not quite as targeted, like immunotherapy, might also be helpful to them. So before saying a few comments with respect to precision medicine, I think it's important to keep in mind that treatment options are broad, they're expansive, and that we shouldn't box ourselves into a particular category of therapeutic approach. We should maintain a broad overview and try to think what's best for a particular patient under her circumstances. So with regard to precision medicine, this is an exciting time, and in fact, I should mention that there's a very large trial going on sponsored by the National Cancer Institute in the United States. It's called the Basket Trial. And basically what it does is it takes patients with a variety of different types of cancers. It looks at these patients' cancers, and it says, if there's a mutation that could be targeted, can we target that mutation therapeutically, give these patients with specific mutations a particular type of treatment, and see how they do? This study is ongoing. The sample size is extremely large, and I think that over the next several months, we'll be learning more broad-based information about targeted therapies and about precision medicine directly as a result of that trial. But I should make the point, to some extent, as already reviewed by Dr. Runowitz, that precision medicine or more personalized approaches are already alive and well in the clinic. And I refer back to what Dr. Runowitz said about PARP inhibitors. As alluded to already, PARP is a particular enzyme that is active in cells that have difficulties with DNA damage and repairing DNA. And specifically, patients who have BRCA mutations, either patients who are predisposed to breast cancer or ovarian cancer who have these sorts of mutations, are particularly vulnerable therapeutically to PARP inhibitors. In other words, I should say that a bit more clearly, their cancers could potentially be treatable with PARP inhibitors. And I think it's important to make the point that many years ago, say 3, 4, 5 years ago, we used to recommend to patients who develop ovarian cancer to go see a genetics counselor because it could help them understand their own risk for cancer, and it could be important for their family members to help their family members understand their own risk for cancer. But we've really moved beyond that. We send patients to genetics counselors now not just to understand risk of cancer, but also because looking at genetics, and specifically BRCA mutations, helps us understand therapeutically whether these agents, the PARP inhibitors, can be used to treat the cancer specifically. And I'd like to say that patients who have a BRCA mutation now are eligible for agents such as olaparib, a PARP inhibitor, once they have had 3 different lines of chemotherapy. Basically, this is an indication when we should start thinking about potentially using PARP inhibitors as a therapeutic strategy to help patients deal with their cancer under these circumstances. So PARP inhibitors are one, I think, very important type of treatment available to some patients with ovarian cancer, and it shows that personalized medicine is actively an option in the clinic for certain patients who have BRCA mutations. Another approach that is used commonly in the clinic is to sequence the tumor. Now, I alluded to the basket trial where, as part of that trial, patients do get their tumor sequenced. In other words, they've had their cancer removed, their tumor is sitting in a pathology department. We take some of that tumor and we sequence it either for the basket trial or in other circumstances, sometimes just to look outside of a clinical trial whether there could be any mutations that could be targeted. Now, I just want to put some perspective on this. There can be some challenges. There have been times when I've had a patient have her tumor sequenced and we say, yes, there are mutations here, but unfortunately, we don't have a drug that we can use to target those mutations. Another scenario that sometimes occurs is that, yes, there's a mutation there, and yes, we have a drug, but it's just too difficult to get that drug. It's not available for ovarian cancer patients. But there have been circumstances where there is a mutation, we have a drug that we can use, we're able to acquire that drug in some manner, and we're able to treat a patient. And under good circumstances, we even see some tumor response. And that's a situation that we hope to see more often, and that over time, we are starting to see more often. In fact, I can tell you that I had a patient just 2 weeks ago where she had had her tumor sequenced well over a year ago. We had no drug back then, but now time has elapsed, and just in the last few weeks, we do have a drug, and she has used that therapeutically to treat her cancer. We're still looking to see whether the cancer is responding, but I think that that pace of drug development helps us better understand how quickly things are moving forward in the treatment of cancer in general and in the treatment of patients with ovarian cancer specifically. yet another example of how personalized medicine is helping patients with ovarian cancer as well as in other cancer types, deals with side effects of chemotherapy or side effects of other types of cancer treatment. Just to give an example, I had a patient the other day who is getting a combination of chemotherapy, drugs that may be familiar to some patients on this call or to their family members, carboplatinum and Taxol. And this particular patient had a very hard time with the drug Taxol. Interestingly, there's a series of enzymes called the cytochrome P450 set of enzymes that can now be examined in a bit more detail clinically to see whether certain patients who might react to chemotherapy with a more notable side effect profile, if they might have polymorphisms or small alterations in these enzymes that might result in poor metabolism of some of these drugs. In this particular patient's situation, we decided to scale back the dose of chemotherapy. We're also looking for mutations or these what we call polymorphisms, and potentially being more aware of how drugs are metabolized will enable us to give chemotherapy in doses that might be less toxic and more well-tolerated. So that's just another take on personalized medicine and how it's currently active in the clinic and how it's helping us help patients more effectively. I alluded to other treatment approaches beyond personalized medicine, and I think Dr. Renowitz did the same. She mentioned this whole issue of VEGF inhibition, or basically interfering with the vasculature to enable cancers to be treated. Bevacizumab, as Dr. Renowitz alluded to, is a prime example of a more generalized approach to cancer treatment. There were recent data on a drug, pertuzumab, which inhibits a particular protein, the HER2 protein, and is showing some very, very preliminary results to suggest perhaps efficacy in subgroups of patients, and perhaps we'll hear more of that line of investigation in the future. Back to this issue of vascular disruption as a way to treat cancer, and specifically ovarian cancer, there's a drug that is currently being tested, fospratabulum, and again, some exciting preliminary results being available. Yet another approach, as I alluded to earlier, entails immunotherapy and actually looking at patients who have ovarian cancer, looking to see whether their cancers tend to be unstable or rapidly dividing with a test called microsatellite instability. And if in fact these cancers seem to have more of a tendency to be rapidly dividing with unstable DNA, sometimes those are in fact the patients who are most optimally placed or positioned to receive immunotherapy type approaches. So I mentioned just a few different approaches available. I would also like to just make sure that patients know that oftentimes there are clinical trials available to them. Sometimes these trials specifically focus on patients with ovarian cancer, but other times these trials are more broad-based and don't just focus on ovarian cancer patients, but cast a wide net and say, we have a drug that seems very exciting. We can potentially test this in patients with a variety of different cancer types, and sometimes ovarian cancer patients feel that they'd like to enter a trial such as that, and sometimes they derive benefit from a very early type of investigation, a phase one trial. So I guess my bottom line is there's a lot going on here in terms of cancer therapy, and ovarian cancer patients are positioned to be able to take advantage of these advances, some of which are currently available to them in the clinic. And beyond that, I'd like to make the point that all of us, not just patients, but also healthcare providers, need to be very broad-based in how we view types of cancer therapy and perhaps not just approach patients about ovarian cancer trials, but also phase one trials, and not just think about personalized medicine, but also other approaches, such as immunotherapy type approaches, that could potentially help people who are dealing with ovarian cancer. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chitoy. That was really excellent, really very information-packed, lots of, and also lots of wisdom in terms of the concept of how treatment decisions are made and the thoughtfulness that goes into it and kind of working with that healthcare team. That's really excellent. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions during the Q&A. This is a very, these two presenters are from very rich information here for everybody to kind of absorb. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Sarah Kerr. Dr. Kerr is a pathologist. She's consultant, divisions of anatomic pathology and laboratory genetics, Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology, assistant professor of laboratory medicine and pathology, Mayo Clinic. And Dr. Kerr is going to address the role of the pathologist and the importance of diagnostic testing in advanced ovarian cancer. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Kerr.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much, Carolyn. I have a topic that gets to go in a little bit different direction from the previous speakers, and so I'm so excited to have the opportunity to talk to patients and families directly about my profession as a pathologist, because in my everyday practice, I don't get to see patients in person anymore, and so I like to have the opportunity to explain what goes on behind the scenes to make a diagnosis for ovarian cancer patients. So let me start first by talking about what a pathologist does in general, because I, even when I talk with family members of mine about what my job is, a lot of them who don't know what I do every day at work think of a pathologist as what they see on TV, which might be involved in what's called forensic pathology or autopsy pathology. In the setting of criminal investigations. And those are also pathologists, and autopsy is an important part of a pathologist's training. But few pathologists actually practice medicine in that way that you see on TV. So on the contrary, most pathologists go to medical school just like your other doctors, but then choose to receive specialized residency and subspecialty training in clinical laboratory testing. So when I talk about laboratory testing, this isn't actually research testing. It's rigorously regulated clinical testing that occurs in the laboratory associated with your doctor's office or hospital. And this specialized training in laboratory testing lasts a minimum of 3 years and can run as long as 7 or more years in learning how to classify tumors and perform diagnostic tests. And so after this training then, a pathologist typically oversees a variety of tests that are done behind the scenes in the clinical laboratory. And this can be anything from routine blood tests, such as for genetic testing for BRCA1 and 2, or examining small tissue biopsies and body fluids to make a diagnosis for a tumor. Sometimes we end up sectioning and examining large amounts of tissue, such as from an ovarian cancer staging or debulking surgery. And this is why your pathologist is so important to your cancer care. Studies have found that up to 80% of clinical decisions are actually based on laboratory test results, including pathology reports. And so your pathologist works with your other clinical doctors to ensure the quality of those laboratory test results that are used in making most of the decisions in your care. A pathologist often advises other physician colleagues on the best diagnostic methods to use to make these decisions, and it helps other physicians understand complex laboratory results in difficult cases. So now I'm going to move to specifically what a pathologist does in ovarian cancer care. Ovarian cancer patients may initially have a small biopsy of tissue or have fluid removed from the abdomen to be examined by a pathologist to confirm a diagnosis of cancer, and to ensure that the disease that is suspected to be arising in the ovary is actually arising there and not in another organ, such as the intestines. This is because the ovary is a place that tumors like to grow, not only as arising in the ovary, but metastasizing from other body sites. So it's very important initially for a pathologist to confirm exactly where the cancer is coming from, because that's very important to determining what treatment might work best. So alternatively, rather than a fluid specimen or a small biopsy specimen, sometimes the ovarian mass is entirely removed for diagnosis to determine both the diagnosis and the extent of the spread of the cancer. A full staging procedure, as one of the previous speakers described, or a debulking procedure is often done to remove as much of the cancer tissue as possible. And the pathologist then is responsible for trying to figure out if this was if all of the tumor tissue that was removed was actually what the surgeon thought was tumor tissue during the operation and so forth. Fluid or tissue specimens are examined by a pathologist under a microscope to precisely classify the tumor. A wide variety of tumors can grow in the ovaries, and so as I had mentioned before, figuring out the type of tumor is very important to determining the predicted behavior of the cancer and the treatment that is expected to work for a particular type of cancer. Sometimes I explain it this way. So using a non-cancer example, if I see a bunch of carrots, for instance, I can tell you that that's a vegetable. If I see an apple, I can tell you that it's a fruit. But if I look at that apple carefully, I might be able to tell you that it's a Granny Smith apple and it's good for pie baking. So the analogy is the same for tumors. So if I look at the cells from a tumor under a microscope, I can usually tell your cancer doctors and you in the pathology report that the tumor might have started in the fallopian tube or ovary and not in an organ like the intestines. And then I can also tell if it's likely to be a fast or a slow-growing cancer or if it's even something that is unlikely to grow back after it's completely removed. And so this step is very important. For example, some of you might have a tumor type called a borderline tumor, and when that's completely removed, your doctors might recommend only observation after surgery because it's considered to be a slow-growing tumor that if it comes back, would come back slowly. But on the other hand, which is more common, if you have a high-grade serous carcinoma, chemotherapy is usually recommended. And so after looking at all of the tissue available and performing additional tests, your pathologist then creates a report for you and your doctors to use in this decision-making. And so then moving on to after the examination and diagnosis of the tissue, the next step is determining a treatment plan. Your cancer doctors often interact with pathologists at multidisciplinary tumor boards where different kinds of doctors review your case and try to agree on what to recommend in difficult situations. So cancer doctors and radiologists looking at your imaging, along with pathologists, can weigh in and give you the most informed opinion possible. The last thing I'm going to talk about regarding pathology is second opinions. I often get a lot of questions about this topic from friends and family members, and so I imagine that it's a hot topic among patients nationwide and around the world. So second opinions in pathology for ovarian cancer care. Unfortunately, even with extensive training and certification, a pathologist's ability to classify a tumor under a microscope is not entirely perfect. So when I look under a microscope, it doesn't have the words serous carcinoma or clear cell carcinoma, which are two different types of ovarian cancer. It really is a subjective examination of what those cells look like, and so pathologists might disagree on a diagnosis. In difficult cases, we show the tissue to other pathologist colleagues and even people who are considered world experts to determine the most appropriate diagnosis for a tumor. Just like other cancer doctors may disagree about what the best treatment is for your cancer, pathologists can also sometimes disagree on a tumor diagnosis. This difference can have a big impact on what treatment is recommended. And so if there's a question about your diagnosis or you're curious, I really encourage you to talk to your cancer doctors about second opinions in pathology, as they can often have a very good sense of when a second opinion on a diagnosis might be helpful in their recommendations to you. And so with that, I hope I've given you a good explanation of the role of what a pathologist does in your cancer care, and I'll be happy to answer any questions after the session. I'm turning the session back over to Carolyn, and again, I'll stay on the line for any questions after.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Kerr. That was really excellent and a really helpful perspective on the role of a pathologist, because many people really don't often have a chance to speak to their pathologist or to understand all the options that are available to them in terms of second look and all those things that are just really helpful what you presented. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. David Washel. Dr. Washel is head, Division of Gynecologic Oncology, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper, Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. And Dr. Washel is a GYN oncologist, and he's going to be addressing follow-up care, controlling side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Washel.
Thank you, Carolyn. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be a part of today's program. To start, I want to give you a little bit of background. The American Cancer Society recently estimated that at the start of this year, there were over 8.1 million female cancer survivors in the United States, and approximately 250,000 of those had had ovarian cancer. It's also estimated that over the next decade, the number of ovarian cancer survivors is expected to increase by over 50,000 women. Interestingly, more than two-thirds of these women were diagnosed 5 or more years ago. So it's clear that with statistics like this, survivorship, or how we care for this ever-expanding number of women, is assuming an increasingly prominent role in how we approach cancer care. When caring for cancer patients, I think it's no longer acceptable to disregard short-term, and especially not disregard the long-term quality of life issues. In regard to general guidelines for post-treatment follow-up of ovarian cancer, they're very broad. So I want to kind of go over what we do at our center, and I hope that will be helpful for people. We generally follow NCCN guidelines. We ask patients to return for office visits every 3 months for the first 2 years following completion of their therapy. Provided that all is well at that time, we schedule visits every 6 months for the subsequent 3 years. When patients are disease-free at 5 years, and at that point their risk for recurrence is really very minimal, we're generally comfortable with visits on an annual basis. When doing the office visits, we take a detailed history, we do a general physical exam, we do a pelvic exam, and we counsel the patients in regard to cancer-specific issues as well as more general health concerns. Things like persistent abdominal or pelvic pain, changes in appetite or bowel function, or vaginal bleeding certainly could be indicative of recurrent disease. In addition, physical findings such as abdominal or pelvic masses and large lymph nodes, they're obviously concerning for disease, but even seemingly unrelated signs such as neurologic changes certainly need to be considered from a cancer perspective. We also ask patients to have a CA-125 level done. Occasionally, we'll use other serum tumor markers as well, and we like to have them drawn prior to each visit so we can review the results with the patient at the time of their office visit. There's a certain amount of controversy in regard to that practice now, and I'm going to discuss that a little bit down the line. Approximately half of patients with early ovarian cancer and 80% with advanced disease will have an elevated CA-125 level at their time of diagnosis. HE4, and some of you may have that drawn as well, it's another serum tumor marker, is elevated in more than half of ovarian cancer patients who have normal CA-125 levels. When elevated at the time of diagnosis, these markers really are a very exquisitely sensitive means of documenting both one's tumor response to the therapy that they're receiving, and then we subsequently use it to monitor patients for recurrence. The rate at which the CA-125 level drops during their initial treatment, and also the range that it ultimately settles in, so for instance in the single-digit range, has at least some limited prognostic significance. In addition, it's clear now that changes in the trend of serial CA-125 levels, and even when they're below the normal level, and often the cutoff is 35 for some assays, it's a little bit lower, so say a change from 5 to 12 to 22, that can be indicative of recurrent disease, so we're very sensitive to that. I always caution patients, though, that little changes from, 9 to 11 to 10 to 12, that generally, with no trend to speak of, is not concerning. Guidelines also offer a range of options in regard to routine imaging, things like CT, PET CT, during this surveillance period. We don't tend to order imaging in asymptomatic patients who have normal physical exams and reassuring blood work. Studies indicate that recurrence is actually better identified by CA125 changes and that we can diagnose recurrent disease an average of 2 months earlier based upon CA125 level than if we had just done serial CT scans, for instance, every 3 months, 6 months, things of that nature. And we also find that it detects disease about 5 months prior to the onset of symptoms or physical findings. Imaging for patients who are at high risk for recurrence but who did not have an elevated tumor marker at the time of their diagnosis are handled on an individual basis in consultation with the patient. When the history, physical findings, or tumor markers raise concern for recurrent disease, then certainly we order imaging. Underlying our protocol is a pretty simple and straightforward concept. The earlier we detect recurrent disease, the better our patients will do. And certainly that makes sense. We would figure that small disease should be more responsive to chemotherapy than large disease. However, the only prospective, double-blind, randomized trial that examined this assumption actually failed to confirm it. This is a very interesting study. It had 265 subjects and their doctors who were notified that their CA125 level had risen to more than twice normal, and at that point, therapy was immediately initiated. For 264 subjects and their doctors, so one less than the other group, they remained blinded to their rising CA125 levels and didn't start treatment until their disease was detected based either on symptoms or findings from a physical exam. What they found was that the therapy was delayed by a median of 5 months in the latter group. However, the overall survival was the same for both groups, and it's interesting in that the quality of life was adversely impacted by the onset of early treatment. However, most gynecologic oncologists in the United States, as best as I'm able to surmise, don't appear to have fully embraced these findings. This study was performed in Europe and the UK, where practice patterns for recurrent disease may be a bit different from ours, and certainly that affects the interpretation of these findings. So one of the things, for instance, that Dr. Runowitz had talked about was management of recurrent disease. When that disease-free interval from the completion of one's primary therapy to recurrence, when it's particularly long, we will consider reoperating. And certainly we want to reoperate and hopefully find as little disease as possible, because clearing that disease is vital in a surgery such as that. Changing tracks a little bit, quality of life for ovarian cancer survivors is often compromised by the physical and psychosocial sequelae of this disease and its treatment. As we all know, side effects can occur during active treatment and can persist for months and actually even years. Neurotoxicity, encompassing numbness and tingling of the hands and feet, muscle cramps, ringing in the ear, and other symptoms actually affect the majority of ovarian cancer survivors. Cognitive dysfunction, what many of us have referred to as chemo brain, is now recognized as a significant toxicity with far-reaching implications. Fatigue and GI toxicity are generally considered to be short-term issues, but actually often they do not completely resolve following the cessation of therapy. These and other symptoms need to be monitored throughout the course of one's treatment and well into the surveillance period. Other issues for our patients are certainly sexual dysfunction and altered body image perception. These are major problems or issues for women with any type of gynecologic malignancy. Menopausal symptoms can be particularly traumatic for younger women who can be thrown into a surgical menopause following removal of these ovaries, of their ovaries. In these situations, we're generally very comfortable when there is not an increased risk for breast cancer in prescribing hormone replacement therapy. When hormones are contraindicated, there are a variety of non-hormonal medications that have also shown benefit. Psychological distress with associated depression and anxiety is also very common in our patient population. This can lead to social impairment, sleep disturbance, and failure to thrive. We feel that it's essential to have social workers, therapists, psychiatrists available to help to meet the needs of these patients. And in wrapping up, you know, I want to point out that really for ovarian cancer, the study of survivorship is really in its relative infancy. However, with a better understanding of these issues by clinicians and with more and more research that is currently ongoing, I really think we're moving into a period in which we'll be able to integrate improved patient survival with enhancement of their quality of life. So with that, I'll end and say thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Washer. That was really excellent, and I'm sure there'll be questions during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Victoria Puzo. Ms. Puzo is an oncologist social worker at Cancer Care, and Ms. Puzo is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial services and programs and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my colleague, Victoria Puzo.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people diagnosed with ovarian cancer and their loved ones, including providing individual support. We've been talking a lot today about managing your care and quality of life, and I just want to talk a little bit about the importance of creating a support network and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs include individual counseling in person in the New York City area and over the telephone on a national basis. We also offer support groups in our offices as well as over the phone and online nationally and internationally. Our education programs, such as the one we're participating in today, as well as some online reading material that people can review. And we have practical help as well as assisting navigating the healthcare system, some limited financial aid. All of these services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, such as myself, and they're all free of charge. One of the biggest things that we've been talking about today is your treatment options, and making those kind of decisions and asking questions can be really overwhelming, and sometimes you don't know where to start, so sometimes it can be really helpful to talk to one of our oncology social workers and just have a sounding board to think of ideas, make a list of questions that you want to ask the doctor, or even just have some suggestions of the questions that you can ask to help navigate making your decision about certain kinds of treatments. All of our oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and their family and friends. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their supports tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. And especially with a disease such as ovarian cancer that can be treated over the course of several years, there's a lot of adjustment that takes place for both the patient and their family and friends. So all this to say, we just want to make sure that everyone knows that you don't have to go through that alone. You can get this kind of support from Cancer Care in the various ways that I talked about, such as telephone counseling, in-person counseling if you're in the tri-state area of New York, and online as well. It's important to feel emotionally supported when you're going through such a difficult time. So that's one of the things that we strive to do here. And just so that you all know, we do offer an online support group specifically for women diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Everybody in that group is anywhere from being just recently diagnosed to people who have had recurrences. So you can get a wide range of support from people who are going through similar types of treatment, making similar types of decisions, and getting ideas about how to deal with some of the side effects that come along with those treatments that you're getting. And then we also offer caregiver support groups online as well. Our support groups are one of our greatest services, just because it really helps to connect patients with other people that are going through the same thing. And then they're also facilitated by an oncology social worker for you to get that kind of professional input as well. So if you're interested in any of the services that I described, we encourage you to call our HOPE line. The number is 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673. That's 1-800-813-4673. Or visit our website, cancercare.org, where you can register for any of our online services. And the website is also comprehensive in finding information on support, practical information, and different ways of coping with your treatment. So lastly, you've learned a lot about from today's program, and it's a lot of information to digest. Everybody had a kind of a short amount of time to give a lot of information. So we just want you to know that if you want to give us a call, we can try to answer questions or steer you in the right direction to get those kind of questions answered. And please feel free to call that hotline afterwards or in the coming days if anything comes up. Thank you for all of your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today, and I'll give it over to Carolyn so we can get some listener questions in.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. Puzo. That was excellent. And now we have time for questions, and we have lots of time for questions. If we don't get to your question, I will explain to you how to get your questions answered. But for now, let's see if we can take as many of your questions as possible. So I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board, first of all, and secondly, to tell you how to queue up for questions so you can ask away and we can see how many of your questions we can take. So, Candace?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Stephanie Kay. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you so much. I think this is a fantastic seminar. Thank you, Caroline, again. Yes, my question is, I've been treated with Taxol about 9 years ago for 2 months weekly. I have peripheral neuropathy in my hands, somewhat in my feet, and I take alpha-lipoic acid and vitamin B6 after advice from an advanced practice nurse. And I want to know if there's clinical studies being done on these two vitamins from Dr. David Weschel.
Thank you for the question. We also use vitamin B6 and alpha-lipoic acid. We'll generally use it when we're giving the chemotherapy. Honestly, there is very little research that's been done to substantiate the use of these two agents. But still, some of our patients subjectively feel that there is improvement. I would say that probably the medication that has shown the most benefit is a drug called Cymbalta. It's an antidepressant, and there has been at least one randomized study that shows improvement of neuropathy in chemotherapy patients. Now, certainly other drugs such as Neurontin, Lyrica, they've shown improvement in patients with diabetes, but their benefits in regard to chemotherapy-induced neuropathy is really very questionable. Again, I have seen some patients who have at least subjectively responded to those two drugs as well, but they tend to have, a fair amount of side effects, particularly sedation, so lots of patients don't like to be on those drugs. And I always caution patients that, all of the medications, what hopefully they're going to do is eliminate the pain that's associated with the neuropathy. They are not going to provide improved function or improved sensation. So it's very important to understand what we're trying to relieve when we provide the treatment.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And our next question, Candace?
And our next question comes from Marlene Kay. Your line is now open.
Oh, yes. Do you have any information about immunology trials for ovarian recurrence?
Oh, thank you for that question. So Dr. Chatoy, do you want to address that?
They are out there, and I think it depends on where you live. And I point out that Dr. Ronowitz had made the point of looking on clinicaltrials.gov. to look for trials within one's community. It's www.clinicaltrials.gov. Keep in mind, too, that there may be some trials out there that are not specific to ovarian cancer or really to any type of cancer, but are just more broad-based cancer trials, and that might be of interest, too. Every once in a while, too, patients, you know, it depends on the circumstances and what's going on, and obviously your healthcare provider would be very attuned to this, but every once in a while, there might be an option for getting immunotherapy treatment